Thank you very much. I'm very happy that the NLG invited me here to share with you the situation in the Philippines today. I'd like to start with a story. In 1985, two young students were posting anti-US basis posters in the streets of Manila, in Taft Avenue, actually, a busy street named after President Howard Taft, actually. The police came, they saw the posters, and then they shoot the two students to death. 7 years later, the Filipino people rejoiced because the U.S. military bases agreement was not renewed, and the end of the military presence of the United States in the Philippines came to an end, or so we thought. Today, we are again in the midst of a conflict, and one of the factors, one of the players in that conflict is, again, the United States, with the presence of U.S. troops in the Philippines. Perpetual war. Unfortunately, the Filipino people had the honor of being an expert in perpetual war in the sense that we have experienced it for so long a time. In 1898, we were invaded by the United States. They overthrew Spain, of course, but the invasion cost so much lives, and the ensuing Philippine-American War cost so much lives, from a low, according to the reports, of 200,000 to a high of 600,000 Filipinos died during the Philippine-American War. One of the bloodiest chapters in Philippine history merited a few pages now in Philippine history books. Nobody seems to want to discuss the fact that we were under at one of the direct, in fact, the only, in fact, probably, direct colony of the United States. Direct in the sense that we had U.S. Governor Generals. Direct in the sense that when we file a pleading in our Supreme Court and we lose in the Philippine Supreme Court, we had to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And until now, U.S. cases play a major role in our pleadings in the Philippines. The United States was not only militarily powerful in the Philippines, but economically and politically as well. So much so that they say no Philippine president will ever win without the blessings of the United States. Culturally, we are also the only odd person in Asia. We're the only one who speaks English in a region that doesn't speak English much. And that was because of a colonial policy instituted upon us. I remember when we were kids, when we were in primary school, we were prohibited from speaking the national language. In fact, we were fined during primary school if we speak the national language. For every Filipino word you speak, you get fined with 5 cents. And for a poor people, that's too much. That's a lot. And I remember when I was in primary school, there was a big slogan in front of our school that says, "Always speak English and be like Neil Armstrong who landed on the moon." So you can just imagine the amount of either fright for being fined and the amount of initiative that we want to land on the moon someday by speaking English. But that was a fact, and that is a fact until now. Next, please. So the Visiting Forces Agreement did not start just then. It started way back in 1898 when the Philippine-American War ensued, and we lost the war, of course. There was a USRP military bases agreement that was signed in 1947 at the very moment when we became, quote-unquote, independent from the United States. It established 23 bases and facilities in the country, including huge, two of the largest bases outside continental USA, Clark Air Base with 26,000 hectares and Subic Naval Base with more than 60,000 hectares. It covers mountains and mountains in the Philippines. But it was not renewed in 1991, and the U.S. military bases were closed. Next, please. So why were the Filipino people very much against the United States bases? We, of course, the main reason that the Filipino people were against the bases was the impingement on our sovereignty. Next. Imagine having foreign troops in your country running around unregulated. And so it's not only a sense of humiliation on our part, but also a sense that we are not truly independent. We are not truly sovereign because a large portion of our territory is occupied by foreign troops. The second reason why we are against the U.S. bases then was because it is used as a launching pad for U.S. attacks on other countries in Asia. The Filipino people would never want to kill the Vietnamese people or the Korean people or the Chinese or whoever for that matter. And yet the Clark and Subic naval bases were used as launching pads to kill our fellow Asians during that time. And that is one major reason why we were very much against the U.S. bases, because we do not want to experience the bombings that the Vietnamese experienced. We do not want to experience the attacks that other countries experience from the launching pads in this major military bases. The other reason that we are against the bases is that because we become magnets of attack. The United States has a lot of enemies around the world. A lot of enemies before and a lot of enemies now. And the presence of military bases or the military presence of U.S. alone is enough reason for their enemies to attack us. And it's a war we are not involved in. It's a war we do not even support. And yet, we could also die as well in the process because of these attacks. The third reason is the violation of our nuclear weapons free policy in the Constitution. Not only are they magnets for attacks, but a nuclear accident can in fact happen in these military bases. And the Filipino government do not have, I'm very sure of it, any contingency or emergency plan in case of nuclear contamination. We cannot even prepare our people for a storm, for a typhoon. How much more if it's a nuclear contamination? Just a few months ago, USS George Washington docked in the ports of Manila Bay. And we found out that it's a nuclear-powered ship. And we found out that it had a major fire last year in Japan. And if there were the same accident in the Philippines, a nuclear contamination or accident would happen, an entire city could actually die because of that accident. That is another reason that we are against the presence of U.S. troops in the Philippines and military bases. And the social cost, of course, must be counted. In these base areas, thousands upon thousands of prostitutes, thousands and thousands of child prostitutes, in fact, smuggling drugs, social ills caused by the presence of soldiers in general. That is why in 1991, the Filipino people rejoiced when the United States military bases agreement was terminated. Next, please. But it doesn't seem to be. The United States continued to covet that important corridor in Southeast Asia. If you notice in the economic statistics, it has a 595 million population with a $700 million GNP. Many countries there are places for investment, and the region accounts for 20% of the world's liquefied petroleum. Next, please. And then, in terms of merchandise, 1.3 trillion of merchandise trade passes through that area way back in 1999. And of course, there is China. So the U.S. government continued to think of returning to the Philippines with vengeance. And that was what happened in 1998 when the United States-Philippine Visiting Forces Agreement was signed by the Philippine government. What is the VFA? Why do we consider it, firstly, unconstitutional? Look at our Constitution. Section 25 of our Constitution states that foreign military bases, troops, or facilities shall not be allowed in the Philippines except under a treaty concurred in by the Senate and recognized as a treaty by the other contracting party. Why did our Constitution create such provision? The Constitutional Commission that drafted the new Constitution after Marcos was overthrown precisely put that in our Constitution so that we will no longer endure the humiliation we suffered during the USRP military bases agreement. When we recognized the bases agreement as a treaty on the part of the Philippines, but the United States refused to recognize it as a treaty and refused to submit it to the U.S. Senate for concurrence. And that is why it is placed there. Next, please. However, under the Visiting Forces Agreement, it was an executive agreement not ratified by the U.S. Senate, but ratified by the Philippine Senate. And that is why we think it is unconstitutional, if only because it did not follow the constitutional requirement with regards the treaty itself. But other than that, I'd just like to... But other than that, the sections itself of the Visiting Forces Agreement is unjust to the Filipino people. Next, please. In the Visiting Forces Agreement, whatever the crimes committed by U.S. troops in the Philippines, the United States retain custody of the erring military personnel. It says under Section 6, the custody of any United States personnel over whom the Philippines is to exercise jurisdiction shall immediately reside with the United States military authorities if they so request. And of course, the United States will always request for custody of any military personnel who committed crimes in the Philippines. That issue came to the fore last year when an American serviceman, a corporal Daniel Smith, was convicted of rape in the Philippines. In that case, the United States immediately requested for his custody, and he was under U.S. custody during the entire time that the trial was conducted. Next, please. Also, in the other provisions, next please, there is no visa or requirement for U.S. troops. In that provision, it says United States military personnel shall be exempt from passport and visa regulations upon entering and departing in the Philippines. While Filipinos and other migrants in the United States are found to have no visa, they are surely treated differently than the Americans in the Philippines. In fact, it's sad to say that we have reports that Filipinos arrested without visa in the United States were treated inhumanely, to say the least, in the United States. And yet, United States troops can come and go into the Philippines without need for visa. That is not only another humiliating aspect, but also the absence of any regulatory tool on the entry of U.S. Soldiers in the Philippines means that the Philippine government and the Filipino people will have no way of finding out how many troops are there in the Philippines. We will have no way of finding out if they are in fact visiting or permanently posted in the Philippines. Visiting, it's not defined in the treaty, in the executive agreement itself, but we have a generic interpretation of what visiting means. It's a temporary thing where you visit a place. But in our country, it was found out later upon the admission of the U.S. Secretary of Defense that the American troops in the Philippines, which numbers from 600 to 1,500 or 2,000 even, have been there permanently for 7 years now. And so this agreement, this portion of the agreement is obnoxious if only because of the fact that we will have no way of finding out the presence and the number of troops in the country. We cannot even inspect military vehicles or ships or planes. That what became an issue during the H1N1 epidemic, because we cannot enter American ships and find out if they are contaminated also, because that was the rule then. You have to inspect, or at least there's a process for entry of foreigners in the country for health reasons. So that's another issue that we have with the VFA. Next, please. And then there's also waiver of jurisdiction. In the VFA itself, it says, recognizing the responsibility of the United States military authorities to maintain good order and discipline among their forces, the Philippine authorities will, upon request by the United States, waive their primary right to exercise jurisdiction. So basically, any crime can be committed in the Philippines, and we need to waive our jurisdiction over these crimes upon the request of the United States government. Next, please. And this is what was the issue during the trial of Corporal Smith, Daniel Smith. It says under the VFA that the confinement or detention by Philippine authorities of the United States personnel shall be carried out in facilities agreed on by appropriate Philippine and United States authorities. So Daniel Smith, upon his conviction for life, he was convicted, was given a life sentence by the judge, served his sentence in the U.S. Embassy. It is not only unjust discrimination in the sense that any other rapist in the Philippines are of course serving their sentence in Philippine penal institutions, but also the fact that the family of the rape victim felt it unjust because they think that Daniel Smith did not, they were not accorded the justice that they so richly deserved. So that is another issue in the visiting forces agreement. Next, please. And of course, this is probably a minor detail. The entry of personal belongings of U.S. Soldiers, of course, are free from any taxation, courtesy of an impoverished Filipino nation. So these are the issues we raised before the Supreme Court, and unfortunately, we lost the case. Next, please. In the Nicolas versus Romulo case, Nicolas is the woman who was raped, which we filed before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided that the VFA is recognized as a treaty. The recognition of the VFA as a treaty, despite the fact that it was not concurred in by the U.S. Senate, was based on the assurance of the ambassador to the United States to the Philippines, Ambassador Hubbard, that the United States recognized the agreement, as a treaty, which is self-serving because Ambassador Hubbard was the one who signed on behalf of the United States the visiting forces agreement. We also asked, because of the recent Supreme Court decision in the United States, Medellin versus Texas, which says, as far as we know, this is what the U.S. Supreme Court said, that a treaty is unenforceable in the United States unless there is a law that enforces it, or it is self-executing. Since the visiting forces agreement, we contend, is not, self-executing, and there is no law executing it, then it must be unconstitutional because it is not a treaty due to the decision in Medellin. However, the Philippine Supreme Court said there is a law that implements the visiting forces agreement, and that is the case of Locke law, which requires agreements by the U.S. President to be submitted to Congress. However, we found out that the case of Locke law actually requires the submission of the U.S. President to the U.S. Congress of any agreement other than a treaty for the monitoring of the U.S. Congress. But despite our arguments, the visiting forces agreement was considered constitutional. Other than the constitutional issues of the visiting forces agreement, however, is the fact that United States troops are involved in combat operations. Again, a repeat of what happened so many years before. There had been cases, reports of massacres committed by the armed forces of the Philippines together with U.S. Marines in various areas in Mindanao. And unfortunately, there seems to be no interest on the part of the Philippine government to investigate the veracity of these reports. One American was arrested when a bomb he was tinkering with in a hotel in Manila, his name is Michael Mering, blew off. And he was taken to the hospital to be investigated, of course, because he was also injured. Why was he having a bomb in his hotel? There were reports already that bombings were conducted in Mindanao, ostensibly conducted by the terrorists, but there were suspicions that they were actually conducted by the Philippine government to create an atmosphere of terrorist attacks. And unfortunately, Michael Mering, the very next day, was whisked out of the hospital by embassy officials and taken out of the country. So he was never investigated for the reasons why he was having bombs in his room in a hotel in Mindanao. Other than that, two U.S. Marines were reported killed more than a week ago during combat operations. So more or less, those are the issues involved in the case of the visiting forces agreement. The combat operations, as I mentioned last night, have been found out officially by the admission of the United States government recently in a New York Times report, which says that they have been there in the Philippines in the last 7 years, and this is how the U.S. the Secretary of Defense said it. They were there and they have decided to stay for another few years. This was an affront to us. If you're a visitor, it is not up for you to say whether you want to stay or not stay. And we thought that the decision of the Philippine government a long time ago for the termination of the bases continues to stand. However, it remains, and the U.S. presence in the Philippines continue. This is the problem that I wish to share with you, and as I mentioned last night, I will be talking with various officials here in the United States to ask for the termination of the Visiting Forces Agreement and the withdrawal of U.S. troops in the Philippines. However, I would like to stress again that the importance we give for discussions with public officials is not as important as the discussions that we will have with you. For in the end, we believe that the change we need, the change that actually matters, is the change that is brought about by the American people. By the American people, together with organizations that, like the National Lawyers Guild, who is seeking reforms and seeking to change American foreign policy. We pin our hopes on you, and we pin our hopes on the American public. There are many things that can be done. There are many things that you can do. For one, in the NLG itself, there is the Philippine desk with Vanessa Lucas as a member, members of the NLG can be active in. Holding a forum or a conference on U.S. involvement in the Philippines would go a long way in helping us making the American people aware that there is another front being opened up in Asia, and that is the second front, so-called, as mentioned by the United States itself, the second front in the Philippines today. Secondly, you can also visit the country and see for yourselves the extent of U.S. involvement in the Philippines today. There will be a major conference of Asian lawyers, a conference of lawyers in Asia and the Pacific, of which the United States is part of, being in the Pacific Rim, because you have attended COLAP so many times. It is sponsored by the International Association of the Democratic Lawyers. It will happen in September of 2010 in the Philippines, and we really hope that the NLG can send a delegation to that conference and be a part of the conference itself, but more than that, to also try to stay behind and discover the presence and the role of United States troops in the Philippines today. Another possible way for you to visit is during the May 2010 elections. On May 2010, there will be presidential elections in the Philippines, and we are inviting international observers, organizing an international observers mission. You know, in the Philippines, many people die during elections. The political party of which I am in, Bayan Muna, or People First Party, in 2004 to 2007, the 2004 and 2007 elections, we suffered 127 dead in our party alone during that period. And the presence of foreign observers helped a lot in decreasing the number of deaths. So that's another way wherein you can come and join and find out about the country and help. Well, actually, it may be a small thing for foreign friends to come and just visit, but it's a big deal for us. In fact, it can save lives in the Philippines. So that's another way you can do it. You can help go visit the Philippines. A third way is you can make representations with your members of Congress or your senators to terminate the Visiting Forces Agreement. You can make representations with your congressman or your President Obama himself if you want, to stop military aid to a repressive Philippine government. Repressive because in the last 8 years, 1,200 people have died due to extrajudicial killings and enforced disappearances. Almost all of us believe in the Philippines, and even the United Nations Special Rapporteur, Philip Alston, believes that the military was behind it, and yet no one has been convicted or prosecuted for these crimes. And yet, there is military aid in the millions of dollars being given by the United States. I am sure that not a single American taxpayer would want a single taxpayer's dollar to be spent on bullets to kill other peoples. And I am sure that if the outrage is so in the United States, there is a chance that the military aid can be stopped. And so those are the things we would like to ask from you. It is said that when the United States sneezes, we catch cold. But more than that, when you do your battles here, we fight harder in other countries. When you smile, we laugh. The effect on us, you have remained one of the most powerful countries in the world. And the impact of your struggles in the United States, the impact of the struggle of the people of the United States, including the National Lawyers Guild, has so much impact on the struggles of peoples outside the United States. In the end, I believe that together we will win this battle for peace. We will win this battle for justice. We will win this battle for peace because we are on the side of the just. We will win this battle for justice because we are on the side of the truth. We will win because we are on the side of the people. Thank you very much.
I feel a little less than prepared because I didn't really write a position paper or prepare anything because I didn't really know I was going to be up here. But David is my comrade, and I have his back as he has my back. So when someone was not able to appear, then I said, of course, I would pitch it and do whatever I could. First of all, much love and respect to Neri, and may your struggle end in victory, and may we understand that we have one common enemy and one fight. Much has been said since the Barack Obama administration began, and I think we really do have to resist all attempts to create a double standard, even in terms of the way that particular administration is critiqued in comparison with other administrations. He's been in office long enough to make a baby. He's been in office 9 months. And 9 months does not erase 4 years, and I dare say 8 years, of the Bush regime or dynasty, or even Clinton's dynasty. Doesn't erase any of what went on before, and that's not to excuse the weak need, lack of direction, lack of leadership that we're seeing. And it's also not to excuse the escalation of the war in Afghanistan. It's not to be confused with our inquiring minds wanting to know exactly when will it end? When will this domination, when will these illegitimate interventions end? And I guess to answer that question, and to answer the question that David poses to myself and Jeannie as to what we can do, we need to go back deep into a little bit of baby boomer history. Now, I went into college in the late 60s, and I remember the last vestiges of the Vietnam War. And I remember that there was still great resistance. I remember every time the ROTC tried to train in broad daylight on our campus, we would demonstrate and picket and heckle them. And we would laugh at our colleagues and our co-students in uniforms and say, "You toy soldiers, you Keystone cops." We would laugh at the presence of the ROTC. And we would protest the recruitment of the CIA on our campuses. And we would protest the recruitment of the FBI on our campuses. And we would protest the presence of multinational corporations waiting to swoop down on students as soon as they got their sheepskins and lift them up into a whole notion of you're now going to be a part of the prosperity of America, when in fact that could never be true for those who were standing inside dark skin and were the descendants of kidnapped Africans. So this thing called perpetual war, what must be done to fight it? First, we have to acknowledge exactly what it is and why it's necessary to be in existence. When we studied, when we first began to study as children in the struggle, we started studying nationalism, we studied Marxism, and we studied how imperialist wars came into being and why they came into being. And what we studied was the theory of domination and why it was necessary to at all times have the presence and the reality of dominations to maintain the vicious cycle of the status quo. And coming from the state of Mississippi, trying to make it real compared to what, as Roberta Flack and Les McCann said so many years ago, it's really easy to make it real compared to what when I think about where I'm from and where my family is from, and that is the state of Mississippi. The state of Mississippi ties with Louisiana, as you know, being the poorest state in the nation. The region where I'm from, the Mississippi Delta, ties only with Appalachia and maybe New Mexico in terms of poverty, in terms of grinding, cyclical, unending, unrelenting poverty. At the same time, the state of Mississippi has the largest regimen of the National Guard. We send more soldiers out to fight in that war than any other state in the United States. We are indeed one of the poorest, if not the poorest state. We do not have health care. Many of our people work at places like Walmart and cannot afford health care, cannot afford a quality of life that is anywhere near survival. And so hanging on by the threads, being promised nothing, not being allowed to because you're too poor to enter into the gates of academia, you go and sign up. And so you say, is there a draft? Well, of course there's a draft. It's a quasi-draft. It's a constructive draft. But when you have no other options for employment, when you have no other options for health care benefits, when you have no other options to take care of your little baby boy and girl, it is indeed a draft system. Because when the poor has no other options, then the thought of entering into the rich man's war becomes the only option. And coming home in a body bag becomes not only a possibility, but in many cases, a reality. And then we look at the way people are treated. We look at how, at one point in our history, the army was completely and totally segregated, and black soldiers were not allowed to fight alongside white soldiers, and they were sent into the most dangerous, most if there is such a thing as an attractive area, most unattractive assignments, if there is such a thing as an attractive war assignment. And nothing really has changed in terms of institutionalized racism and extreme poverty. This government continues to try to, with all its might, claim that class is not an issue. And those of us who have not shaken off, or not, as the great thinkers said, committed any form of class suicide, sometimes we buy into that. We actually believe it, and we sort of peddle that, maybe soft peddling, because we don't do any polemicking around it, but we certainly don't do anything to draw those lines clearly and explain what the relationship is between the imperialist system and the wars that maintain it. And how do the wars maintain it? You look at the early liberation struggles on the continent of Africa. Each time there was a chance that one of those struggles would be lifted up in real liberation and self-determination, not a prop-up like a Mobutu-type prop-up regime, but an actual Lumumba-type liberation regime. Whenever that happened, New Jewel Movement in Grenada, Congo, wherever it happened, and Thomas Sankara, so short was his reign, so short was his tenure as president. We saw him speak in New York City up in Harlem. 2 weeks later, he was assassinated. So every time there was a real legitimate attempt to really fight off and shake off the domination of imperialism, the swoop in, the coups came and destroyed. So that is what we mean when we say that war is actually the economic financial arm of imperialism. It is the arm that says you can exist as long as you don't get out of line. So what do we need to do? Because that's really what it's all about. First, we have to recognize that it is necessary to maintain these systems of exploitation. The gang up brute force is required to seal off the empire and protect it from the restless natives of all stripes. And so in case you think the natives only come in brown or black skin, the natives are anybody who stands against the status quo and says, look, there's got to be something more than this. And then again, how dare you question that? And if you keep questioning that and you dare to have dialogue, or God forbid you march on us, then we got to put you down. So the terrorist front forms a wall around the spoils and treasures, the stolen wealth and stolen people too. The culture of foot soldier justice ensures that young boys and girls will go off to war thinking that they actually are soldiers doing something patriotic and great, and come back maimed and even in a body bag. The order of wealth and prosperity in the midst of grinding poverty. And so the resistance movement has to match that. The resistance movement has to call forth a historical memory of when we didn't just sit around and let this stuff happen. And we can't now go into peekaboo mode. We can't now go into a wait and see mode. We can't now suddenly equate being afraid of being called racist with being critical, with being in protest mode, no matter who is at the helm of the empire. And Richard said it on the first night, and then again, it was most eloquently stated during our African plenary, where it was stated, well, look, Barack Obama, surely, when you look at Bush and the other knuckleheads, of course, he's pedigree, he's smart, he sounds good. He doesn't embarrass us when he goes out and he speaks. Bush, we're hanging our heads, lurking in a corner, trying to keep from letting anyone hear our American accent because we're so embarrassed by his phonetic inaccuracies and everything else about him. But now we got this polished pedigree. Okay? We can't confuse that, though, with some overthrow that never happened. We can't confuse that with socialist revolution. We got to be just as vigilant. We got to come out in greater numbers. The campuses are so quiet now about the war. The campuses are letting Barack, giving Barack a pass on the Afghanistan piece, and forget about Iraq. But on Afghanistan, who is even having the debates that need to be had? Who is really mounting serious protest movements? It's because of the fatigue. And it's also because in some ways the middle class character of some of the work had us vacillating back and forth and saying, well, 20 years, I thought this stuff was going to be over. I did my time. Now I got to go collect my trust fund, or I got to go get a real job. You know, all of those things that we are privileged to be able to do, which the sufferers that we are pleased and privileged to stand beside never get to do. We got to shake that stuff off. We got to be more bold. We got to be more graphic. We can't be 8.5 by 11 when the imperialist forces are like 24 by 24 and you're walking around with a handout like this when you should have big placards with people with their heads hanging off and their arms blown off. You gotta be graphic. You know how the pro-abortion, and they're scary, but they will show you pictures of blown up babies. Of course the stuff is genetically and biologically crazy, but they do what they have to do. They foam at the mouth to get their point across, where we're being cute and trying to worry about, well, I don't want to be considered racist. I mean, you got the first black president. I mean, my God, I got to go slow here. I got to do the peekaboo because I don't want anybody to think that I'm criticizing Barack Obama. I'm a black woman. I'm proud to say that my grandchildren are living in an era where there's the first black president. That will get me a calendar that has his picture along with George Washington Carver and Phyllis Wheatley. That will get me on Black History Day being able to celebrate a new phase of history and say we have the first black president. It's feel good stuff and we want to feel good. But when you shake that off, we're in a nightmare. And you can't come out of a nightmare saying, whoa, glad I woke up, man, I feel much better. You got to deal with what you were dreaming when you were in that nightmare. So it's important not to evade the issue of protest. It's important to have forums like Neri said. We need to have many, many more. The Guild needs to hook up with other legal organizations and have just a barrage of pop-ed pieces all the time. We need to do billboards. In our organization, we put up billboards. We put up a billboard about sexual harassment that said, did he touch you? Did he threaten to fire you if you said no? Sexual harassment is a crime. What about a billboard that says, wouldn't you rather have a job than go to war? Okay? Wouldn't you rather go to college than have a low-wage job? See, they won't deal with the issues that cause our young brothers and sisters to go to war. They go to war because they don't want to work at McDonald's. They go to war because they don't want to end up at Walmart, where they won't even be able to afford the health insurance. So if we don't address the fundamental issues of exploitation and the system that we languish under, we're just really barking at the moon. And so my suggestion is that we go in deep, deep, deep righteous indignation, deep, deep protest mode. That we do the marches again. We never should have stopped because we're not free. You know, and Rosa Parks gave her last speech at 92. I plan to be right there. When I'm 92 years old, I'm going to be saying the same thing. This stuff is not working. And even if I'm on a cane, I'm going to be pointing that cane and giving the finger and doing whatever I got to do to let them know I'm not down with it. Even as I approach twilight, I'm not down with it. And if we don't do that, if we don't have young resistance spirits, nobody's going to remember us for when we used to do something and now we're going to let you all have it. We got to stand beside our young brothers and sisters. This out to pasture nonsense about retirement is just crazy. You retire when we're free. You retire when there's no war left that our children are going to fight. You retire when everybody has health care and a hospital bed when they get sick. You retire when every prop-up dictator is crushed. You retire when every glossy pedigree trickster, even if it happens to be the newest president, you retire when all of them are checked and exposed. That's when retirement comes, when liberation comes, then I can go and join an all-girls band or do backup singing with Tina, who is just ageless, and I can stand behind her doing my steps and, you know, doing my twirls and really not feel guilty about having a music career instead of a resistance career. Yes, we all want to paint flowers and trees, but damn if those bombs are not still coming. We got to deal with the bombs that are still coming and the landmines that our children have to deal with. So if you're ready to talk seriously about staying in their faces throughout this administration and all the ones to come, then let's hook up. Let's hook up and let's do it. Thank you.
Seem to be following Jaribu last night and now. Well, the topic of this major panel is perpetual war or the rule of law. Okay, so I'm here to talk about the rule of law. And while I agree, there's no way to disagree with what anything that Jaribu said about the way we need to take our activism seriously and be constantly vigilant about fighting these wars. We need to also talk about whether or not the rule of law can be an antidote to perpetual war. Sometimes I like to say, what does international law or domestic law have to do with it? And that would be sort of a Dina thing, but I really can't get into that. But when one thinks of the concept of rule of law, context is everything. In the context of apartheid or de jure segregation, seeking to uphold the rule of law is to preserve the status quo for those who made the laws, the elites who benefit from them, and in those contexts, it's proper to ask whose rules and whose laws. But in the context of a state in which the rights of people are abused at will without consequences, so that a state of impunity for violating rights is extant, a call to follow the rule of law is both a call for rights and accountability. It's in that latter sense of the rule of law that I speak to you today. The United States, as you've heard, has untold military bases around the world, a huge army, largely populated by people who need the work, a military-industrial complex, and as Richard Falk told us the other night from the story of the Vietnamese general, who said, I don't know if you were all here, but he told the story of, even despite our military superiority and so forth, when the U.S. general talked to the Vietnamese general at the end of the war, he said, the U.S. general said, you never conquered you militarily, or we never lost militarily. And he said, yes, and that's irrelevant. So the other aspect of this is really that militarism and the use of military doesn't solve problems. And we know that. But I want to talk to you about the wars that we're in. And Jaribu mentioned escalation in Afghanistan. We're still in Iraq. We're looking at sanctions or some other potential in Iran. There's Korea. There's all of these other areas, and who knows where next. So I dare say that it's incumbent on lawyers to understand what the law is with respect to going to war. And that is something I'm going to talk about a little bit because given the breadth of our military bases, there is absolute silence when we hear about wars being talked about. Something comes up, everybody immediately assumes a military option. You have not heard any of the debates on Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan. Has anybody heard the word United Nations Charter and whether it's legal under the United Nations Charter? I mean, there was some attempt in Iraq to get a second Security Council resolution, but they knew they couldn't get it because it was illegal. So let's talk a little bit about that, because as lawyers we need to know this aspect of what the law actually says about war and peace. How many people here have read the UN Charter? Some, not everybody. I suspect probably Anne has it memorized, but I haven't. I certainly would never. I would never assume to be in that league, in Anne's league. But I would say that we should think back for a moment to the period after World War II, which was an important moment in the history of the world. Because at that time, we came out of two wars. It was really two wars. World War I, where millions of people died. Millions, millions of people. Imperialist war. And World War II, where another millions and millions of people died. And there was this collective view that this shouldn't be able to happen again. Now, the people who had this collective view at that time were the so-called allies, which included the United States and the Soviet Union. And their initial idea for the United Nations was not really to have anything to do with human rights or whatever, but there was this notion that these big powers coming out of World War II could provide a collective security shield for the rest of the world. And that's all it was going to be. They were really going to be able to have prevent wars from happening because they had they came out of World War II in a militarily superior position than the defeated countries, and there you go. But it wasn't until groups around the world decided to make that idea of building institutions that would prevent war, not just only out of collective security, but raising issues of human rights, decolonialization, all of the issues that are part of the UN structure, from the Economic Social Council, UNESCO, etc., UNICEF, all of those institutions came about because the people got involved in the charter building, and including the National Lawyers Guild representatives demanded that they have more human rights aspects as part of the charter. And although in the fight between sovereignty versus human rights, sovereignty won, which in essence gives is an inherent flaw or an inherent tension in the charter, we now have a charter that does say, as its primary purpose, that all member states shall settle their international disputes by peaceful means in such a manner that international peace and security and justice are not endangered. That's Article 2, Section 3. Article 2, Section 4 says, all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force, against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or any other or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the UN Charter. These are the fundamental principles. There is only one way that war initiated by a state can legally happen, and that is under Article 51, where you have self-defense. Now, the inherent right of self-defense is, however, very narrowly construed. If you remember the old Caroline case, what self-defense is if you're attacked, self-defense states that, if there is an attack, you can repel the attack. But you have to bring it immediately to the Security Council and have the UN take over. Supposedly, we can't say, all right, you now that we've been attacked, we can go and do whatever we want. Article 51 requires that the state take the issue to the UN for the Security Council to address. If we think we're going to be attacked, and we haven't yet, then the so-called Caroline case becomes the rule of law, which is that you can only use self-defense in that sense where the threat is instant, overwhelming, and leaving no choice and no moment for deliberation. Now, what we've engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places are wars that are illegal under international law and under domestic law because the UN Charter is a treaty that the United States signed and ratified. We need to keep that in mind. And none of the bases on which we have been at war have been justified under Article 51. The other areas of law that govern whether we can go to war involve the Nuremberg Charter and crimes against peace. We really need to understand these. This is not, it's not like we can hold up a piece of paper and say, this is why you can't go to war. But there has not been in the discourse about any of these wars the question of legality. And as lawyers, we have a special obligation to bring that up. I've written a white paper on Gaza, on the illegal, the legal issues implicated in the most recent Israeli attacks on Gaza. And that should be on your desk. A lot of the things that I'm saying here today are on that paper. I've extrapolated from that paper, because in reality, what happened in Gaza is just the same as an illegal war that the United States is engaging in. We may think that it is inevitable that an empire in decline, as the U.S. is, face it, fellas, we're broke. But that doesn't mean we're not going to stop these crazy and suicidal actions of military actions on our way down. But the question is, can we stop it? These military interventions are not inevitable. There is nothing inevitable in history, because people make history. Thank you.